So this is our reading group, continuing our reading of Neo-Vitalism. We're in the chapter Absolute Domains and Finality, picking up from page 120 of the translation. So the last little bit, he was going over this sort of thought experiment that comes from Norbert Wiener's book Cybernetics. And so in that book, there's some discussion of thermodynamics. And of course, thermodynamics is there's a close relationship between thermodynamics and information. So entropy, as sort of one of the core concepts of thermodynamics, is kind of like the inverse of information. sometimes you see the term negentropy, like negative entropy, in like cybernetics literature. And so, like, the arrow of time in thermodynamics goes from an ordered system with low entropy. So you can think of something like an ice cube, which has like this crystalline structure, for example. And then the arrow of time is towards a higher entropy, so a less ordered system. So the ice cube melts. Actually, maybe the ice cube is not really a great example here, but the better example would be something like, the block of ice has a different temperature than the surrounding air. The air is considerably warmer than the ice, so you have this like structure of differentiation between two regions that have different temperatures, and you could use that difference of temperature to perform work of some kind. So in this case, melting the ice is work. And then, as if you just leave that block of ice on your counter, the ice will melt and you'll eventually just have a giant puddle of room temperature water on your counter that you have to clean up. And so here the water and the air have the same temperature and you can no longer perform work using the water air interface or separation. So this is sort of like the arrow of time in thermodynamics, is the passage from low entropy to high entropy. Once you have this low entropy or this high entropy state at the end of the once the system is at an equilibrium state, then you can't perform work anymore using that system. Norbert Wiener gives this sort of thought experiment of supposing that there were entities somewhere in the universe that had a sort of reverse arrow of time to ours, and he suggests that it would actually be impossible for us to communicate with these entities. Like, supposing there's like sort of like reverse humans or reverse intelligent beings, that like their arrow of time is opposite to ours, and we would say try to communicate with them, or they would try to communicate with us. He suggests that, or he argues that, whatever means that these beings would use to try to communicate with us would sort of appear from our perspective as just some sort of natural phenomenon. So like the example that Rie talks about here is, if you suppose one of these beings were to, say, draw a square in the sand. So if you picture, you're on a deserted beach and you come across, a perfect square drawn in the sand, you would sort of assume that there was some, another person or some sort of intelligent being that drew this square in the sand. Nature doesn't tend to, draw squares. In the case of this, reverse thermodynamic order of time being, if we were to sort of observe this, or if this being were to try to send us a message by drawing a square in the sand, what we would see is sort of the reverse of the degradation of that square. So you'd see sort of like the particles of sand, the little grains of sand would sort of be, blown by the wind or pushed by the tide or whatever. There'd just be some sort of seemingly natural process that would, maybe surprisingly, but still fully sort of physically explainably result in a square. So you would maybe think this, that's some sort of bizarre, crystallization process, or some sort of weird wind pattern in this region or whatever. But everything would just look as if there were just these sort of mindless physical forces that result in a square, being produced in this region. Whereas, of course, for the, from the perspective of this reversed order of time being, they're, drawing the square in the sand, and then that square is sort of being degraded by physical forces like wind and tide and so on. Wiener argues that any sort of attempt to create a message that this being would try to send to us, or, you know, the other way around as well, would just appear from the other side as like some, you know, peculiar natural phenomenon, in the same way that, like, you know, we can see crystals that have this, like, you know, interesting geometrical structure, but, you know, we can see how they form just through, you know, physical interactions of molecules and so on. And there's no, like, we don't assume that this, you know, regular crystalline structure is like a message being sent to us by an intelligent being. And what Rie points out here is that it's not maybe entirely correct to say that we would not be able to communicate between, you know, across this sort of reversed order of time, because living beings are precisely sort of inverted order of time relative to, you know, this sort of physical aggregates, like, you know, the square drawn in the sand. So living beings are not closed thermodynamic systems. Of course, living beings are constantly taking in nutrition. You know, they're taking in structured chemicals that they can break down and use to perform work. So living beings, so you can think of, for example, an embryo, you know, one of his favorite examples, the embryo that develops into, you know, a chicken or a fish or a human or whatever it is. It's starting from this sort of undifferentiated state and developing this, you know, complicated structure. This is almost, in a sense, is the opposite sort of trajectory as, you know, the complicated structure of, say, a human body after death that is, you know, decomposed into the simple, you know, chemical substances. So living beings are, in a sense, the sort of reverse order of time thermodynamic entities that Norbert Wiener is sort of postulating in his thought experiment. But of course, that doesn't mean that it's not possible for, you know, two living beings to communicate with each other, or for living beings to interact with non-living sort of aggregates like an ice cube that, you know, melts over time, etc. But what Rie, sort of the sort of like next stage of the argument here, is that Rie does point out that there is sort of like a kernel of truth in Wiener's argument, because this sort of reverse thermodynamics of living beings is, in a sense, something that is not sort of graspable in terms of physical laws, in the way that, say, the evolution of a straightforward thermodynamic system is. So, you know, you can come up with simple or relatively simple thermodynamic laws that explain how a steam engine works, but you can't come up with simple thermodynamic laws that explain how, I don't know, say, a chicken works. And so there's something about this form production or form, you know, genesis of form in living beings that is sort of not graspable in terms of simple physical laws. There is this sort of like, you know, from the perspective of the physical laws that apply to aggregates like the ice cube, a living being is kind of something extra physical in that sense. But of course, the sort of better perspective that Rie is going to, or that is sort of underlying what Rie is talking about here, is that it's actually this, what from one perspective is the reverse order of time. So the form taking of the embryo, for example, that's actually the more fundamental sort of level of reality, is these true forms, which includes not just living beings, but also, you know, molecules, subatomic particles, etc. This is the more fundamental reality. And it's actually the aggregates, like the ice cube, like the steam engine, that are sort of the, not exactly illusory, but are sort of like the secondary phenomena that result from interaction of many true forms. So yeah, it's a sort of a complicated argument, because they're sort of like switching back and forth between these sort of two perspectives of like treating, like the maybe the more sort of like standard scientific conception, which sort of starts from looking at aggregates and the thermodynamics as like the sort of the paradigm science of aggregates, and then sees living beings as a kind of exception or problem case. And then the sort of almost like a Gestalt switch, where, you know, where you see the stairs from above instead of from below, where you switch over to seeing the seeing living beings, or, you know, true forms as the fundamental entities, and then aggregates as a kind of secondary product of their interaction. So that's sort of what's going on in the last section that we read just before, or when we ended last week. Okay, so I think we can pick up from page 120 at the heading E.
I can read. E, autoconduction and finality. At the end of this analysis, we can conclude that the notion of absolute domain contains the key to finalist activity. We've been able to show that all the notions we can quickly extract from the constellation of finality are connected, directly or indirectly, to the very notion of such domains. Work activity, which aims for a definite optimum in the various orders of values, not simply spatial but temporal organization, which dominates the subordinate causal step-by-step chain and regulates it, coordinated possibilities, allowing choice and freedom, invention at all levels through the passage from forms to senses and from senses to forms, which not only permits the regulation of step-by-step chains, but creates the means or the auxiliary connections. A single point remains to be clarified, and it is pivotal, not only for psychology, but also for metaphysics and even theology. The finality at issue here is a quote-unquote harmony finality, not quote-unquote intention finality. In other terms, a domain of survey is not a keyboard at the disposal of a distinct quote-unquote subject or quote-unquote mind, pianist, so to speak. The keyboard is capable on its own of autoconduction. In what appears in the universe of sense is the intention, project, goal of a man who speaks to us about what he desires for tomorrow and what he does today to prepare for it is the expression of a primary harmonization in this man's consciousness. Like perception's mise-en-scène, in which the subject seems focused on what he perceives, intention finality, quote-unquote spoken finality, is a secondary technique that should not be transposed into the primary nature of finality. Were it otherwise, it is obvious that we would merely have a pseudo-solution, which would not in fact avoid infinite regress. Even when it is an intelligent activity dominating the plane of perception, consciousness is not distinct from the intuitive or symbolic domain on which it is exerted. Cerebral equipotentiality gives the impression that the mind is detachable from the brain it uses, whether this brain is damaged or not. In reality, once the brain is totally destroyed, quote-unquote, user vanishes. It is often inevitable, we've done it ourselves, to personify the quote-unquote surveying unity of an absolute domain, to realize the division into unity on the one hand and into multiplicity on the other. But we should always remember that we are only dealing with metaphors here, because the survey is quote-unquote absolute without quote-unquote distance. When in the place of the pseudo-finalism and pseudo-spiritualism Anaxagoras, whose nous is nothing more than a blind motor force, Plato wanted to define an authentic finalism in the Timaeus. He was inevitably forced to separate the actor, the demiurge, and his domain of activity, the world, and even to further separate the created world and the ideal model. Erudite commentators puzzled over the exact meaning Plato attributed to this myth in whom Plato's true god was, the demiurge of the good. But Plato did nothing else than faithfully describe the very structure of every finalist activity. By definition, we do not turn the mind into a simple fluid. We have to decompose it into acting subject and domain of action, and the latter into actual domain and domain of possible ideals. On the cosmic plane, Platonic demiurge is the X or the active unity of experience. Quote, there is work, unquote, just as the good is the value that defines the ideal pole of the same. Quote, this same, quote, there is work, unquote. It is even more difficult to determine the extent to which Plato believed in his myth, that is, realized this double division, because he probably did not know it himself. At any rate, the notion of absolute domain should allow us to conserve from this myth just enough not to relapse into Anaxagoras's pseudo-finalism in one form or another. At the same time, we will not take seriously the division that transposes harmony finality into intention finality. I'll stop there. Yeah, I think this is a point that we've touched on a couple of times in this group, which is that the surveying unity is not like a ghost in the machine Like it's not a ghostly piano player that sort of plays the parts of the brain, for instance. Instead, as he puts it at the top of 121, what seems to be an intention is it's a harmonization of the brain, but I don't know if that's exactly right, because Rie distinguishes between the brain as for itself and the brain as an observed object. So maybe it would be right to say that it's a kind of harmonization of the for itselfness of the brain, which to an external observer looks like the intention of a subject that is sort of separate from the scene that it is surveying. So in reality, it's just consciousness just is the scene of absolute survey that it has at the time, and not, you know, an observer or an agent behind that scene in some way.
Yeah. This bit about right at the end of the passage that you just read, the harmony finality and intention finality. I think here, maybe this we can map this onto the demiurge sort of myth that he's taking from the Timaeus here. So in the Timaeus, the way it's sort of depicted is, you know, the demiurge is sort of looking at this ideal model of the cosmos, and then sort of forming the matter that's sort of just there. You know, the demiurge doesn't create the matter, but the matter is sort of there for the demiurge to use. And the demiurge sort of looks at this model and then sort of uses that to build the universe on this model. So here we have a sort of intention finality, where, you know, there's a kind of separation between the agent and the you know, action. So the agent is sort of separate from what they're acting on, in the same way that, you know, the piano and the person playing the piano are separate entities. And then I think the harmony finality would be more like sort of internal to the demiurge themselves. So that the demiurge, maybe looks at the model to build the universe, but when the demiurge, you know, picks up, in this, you know, sort of metaphorical sense, picks up some piece of matter and gives it a certain form, that is not itself done by looking at a different, like a sort of sub model, if that makes sense. You know, we act with certain intentions, that action, sort of aiming at a goal or a target or, you know, following a model or whatever, has to sort of bottom out in actions that are not themselves, sort of directed at a goal, in like an external goal in that sense. So, you know, your goal might be to throw a dart at a bullseye, and you have like the, you know, your external target in a very literal sense here, but you don't have to sort of have a goal of like moving your arm. Like that's not a sort of goal that you set yourself to perform as a sort of external target that you have to hit. It's just something that you sort of immediately do as a means of performing that action, and, you know, reaching the goal of hitting the bullseye. Although, you know, of course, there are like sort of special cases, like you can imagine, you know, someone who suffered, you know, nerve damage, and, you know, is relearning how to move their arm. Maybe moving their arm is the goal. That could be something you can sort of set yourself as a target. But in the case of, you know, a person who has, you know, sort of normal mobility, moving your arm is something that just sort of immediately happens as a way of acting to achieve a certain goal. I think that's sort of the division here, is that this harmony finality is just sort of like the sort of imminent coordination of the action, as opposed to the action being directed towards an external goal.
I can read the next section if we're ready to move on.
Yeah, I think so. I think you can probably take us to the end of the chapter. It's like about two pages. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. All right. It is the merit of Gestalt theory that it escapes every temptation to divide things, because, according to this theory, order and harmony are spontaneously constituted by a pure equilibrium, without a distinct active subject or a distinct order of value. Regrettably, however, Gestalt theory is just a pseudo-finalism. The pure harmony finality is no longer a finality at all. It is remarkable that Leibniz, by virtue of his dynamist principles, could have applied avant la lettre, a kind of Gestalt theory, to metaphysics and theology by a, quote, divine mathematics in which the determination of the maximum takes place, end quote. The essences and the possibilities in the divine understanding pass into real existence according to their weights, which are conjugated with virtual existence. Leibniz believed he could speak of divine freedom and of God as final cause, the moral and not simply metaphysical perfection of the world. But truth be told, we do not see how this extremal dynamism is still a finalism. In reality, God plays no role in this matter. He is simply the site of possibilities, just as space is the site of existence. Leibniz's metaphysics is less mythical than Plato's, but it rests in an inadequate description of finalist activity. Leibniz's conception is not far from Hume's. Quote, a mental world or a universe of ideas, such as the divine understanding, the site of possibilities, requires a cause as much as a material world or universe of objects, end quote. And if we reply that their different ideas that constitute the supreme being's reason fall into order on their own and by their very nature, quote, why is it not as good sense to say that the parts of the material world fall into order of themselves and by their own nature, end quote. To take the conceptions of Plato, Leibniz, and Hume on cosmic finality for what they are, a simple magnifying glass that reveals the way in which finality in general can be conceived, we can say that the Platonic conception deploys the best phenomenology of finality. If Leibniz conflates dynamic equilibrium and finality and degrades the divine understanding into pure, ineffective sight, Hume, to the extent that Philo is his authentic mouthpiece, is so preoccupied with avoiding infinite regress, which is laudable, that he passes the analysis too early and does not see the essential difference between a collection of material objects juxtaposed in physical space, parts of the material world or the objects scattered on the physical surface of a table, and a set of form or of ideas in a domain of absolute survey, the universe of the ideas of divinity or the view of the objects on the table. If my table is in disorder and in an apartment and I never enter, the objects that clutter it will have no chance of putting themselves in order. As soon as my gaze falls on this table, however, I can order the idea objects that constitute the absolute surface of the seen table according to the sense of my aesthetic, theoretical, social activity. And yet, there is here no risk of infinite regress. It would be puerile to believe in a kind of quote-unquote over-consciousness, quote-unquote over-perceiving, and quote-unquote over-willing, which would once again see the seen surface of the table and decide to tidy it up. But an absolute surface should at least be reached for there to be order and finality. In this instance, the fundamental illusion lies in believing that the surface of the seen table differs from the material table simply by sort of illumination. According to this metaphor, by turning on the light in the room, which I can eventually do without being present in it, through an external switch, I will not alter the order of the objects on the table. But consciousness, knowledge, and self-survey are not akin to an illumination. They are the presence of a primary mode of bonding, which subjectively exists as an absolute domain and is objectively manifested as equipotentiality. The seen objects are no longer alongside one another like the material objects. They form part of a unitary system that acts unitarily. To believe that the seen objects will continue to exist and to act as material objects, capable at the very most of blindingly pushing one another, is to arbitrarily dissociate consciousness's mode of existence and its mode of acting, even though the mode of existence is nothing other than the abstraction of the mode of acting. The subject, the surveying unity, the Platonic demiurge, is the unitary action in the present participle. It is the acting, the present participle substantialized. The material objects as clusters or machines operate only according to their structure and their step-by-step bonds. From fonctionnement, I guess here in French, functioning, a substantialized present participle, which would be fonctionnant, the French for functioning, does not spontaneously emerge. Clusters or machines act as quote-unquote subjects only in sentences. By contrast, an active pole emerges from the unitary action inherent in the absolute domain, a pole that appears opposed to the passive domain that undergoes the tidying up according to a sense. So yeah, I think here we also, again, we see Ruyer's, he must have been an incredibly tidy person. But to me, I feel like the main point he's getting at is pointing out that what we assign to just simple like material cause and effect is not a sufficient explanation for a lot of activity in the world.
Yeah, I think this bit on Leibniz and Hume is an interesting one, because I think we've talked about Leibniz before, either in this reading group or the one on the cybernetics book. And of course, you know, Ruyer's position as a kind of monadology in a way. And so, yeah, understanding how it differs from Leibniz's position, I think, is an important one. And so his criticism of Leibniz here is that Leibniz sort of insufficiently differentiates or doesn't make enough of a differentiation between true forms and aggregates. So Leibniz, of course, focuses on his sort of model for what a monad is a living being that has a sort of intrinsic existence. It exists for itself. And then Leibniz takes it that the whole universe, every particle of matter is a monad in this sense. But there's no sort of room in Leibniz's system for something that would not be a monad. So it seems like we either have to have there's only monads all the way down and all the way up. Everything is a monad. And so any sort of anything that we want to attribute existence to in under a sort of Leibnizian system would have to be a monad. And this would sort of lead to either denying that tables exist, which is a kind of a strange claim to make, or having to claim that a table has a sort of for itself sort of monadic existence, which also seems rather strange, a strange claim to make. What this distinction between true forms and aggregates enables us to do is to describe the table as precisely an aggregate of many true forms. There are molecules and atoms and electrons and so on that make up the table, and each of those is a true form, but the table itself is just an aggregate. It doesn't have a sort of intrinsic existence. The other side of this is that my sort of mental life, my inner life, is sort of like the inner life of a true form. So perceiving the table. So when I look at the table, the table has a sort of unity as an element or as a component of my inner life. There is a perceived table as a sort of entity that, this is sort of like a, classic Gestalt theory argument about how, the perceived table is, separated from the background, that I see it against and so on. I think this example, this is one of these instances of this like very concrete example that he's, really, I think, great at coming up with, is that, the table, if you just have like a bunch of, junk on your table, mail that you should have opened 3 weeks ago and whatever, and then you, leave your apartment and, don't come back for decades, the letters that you should have opened, empty Coke cans or whatever, all the stuff that's on your table is not going to sort of spontaneously tidy itself up. It's all just going to be more or less where it was, you know, and then whatever, you know, wind or whatever other sort of random events happen that, you know, might disturb it in the meantime. But if you, you know, have the exact same messy table and you walk into the room, you can sort of your action as a being that has a sort of orientation towards values like, you know, tidiness or some sort of aesthetic sense of what a table should look like, can sort of act on the world in such a way as to organize the table, to, you know, throw out the empty cans and, you know, open the mail and sort it, et cetera. So you as a being who is capable of grasping the arrangement of stuff on the table and, you know, using your sort of orientation towards aesthetic values or organization values or whatever to act on the table, you are capable of sort of bringing about an organizing or tidying of the table in a way that the sort of aggregate of entities on the table is never going to be able to do. So it's precisely because you are a true form, it's precisely because of that you are capable of arranging the table in accordance with some, you know, value, whereas the entities on the table by themselves are not capable of doing anything like that. And of course, you know, another true form, you know, say there's like a bunch of mice get into your apartment over those decades that you leave it, their sort of arrangement of the stuff on your table is probably going to be very different from what you would do if you were to, you know, clean up your table. They're probably going to, I don't know, build a nest or something. And, you know, from a human perspective, that would be a big mess. But from the mouse perspective, this is like, you know, perfect nest arrangement. So the true form mouse is arranging the stuff in accordance with a different orientation to a value than the human who is cleaning up the table. But it's still it's still a sort of form giving to the junk on the table. So yeah, there might be different sort of orientations to values that constitute you know, acting on this junk and, you know, ordering it. So, you know, what is ordering from the mouse's perspective might be disordering, or, you know, making a mess from my perspective. In each case, this order giving, or this, you know, giving order to the junk on the table is always going to be the action of a true form, and not just a sort of spontaneous interaction of the aggregates of stuff on the table.
Yeah, this is maybe kind of a minor point, but I've been thinking about like, even, you know, color constancy and object constancy and like visual depth and all of this complex stabilization that happens, you know, to the initial like sensory input at the retina, all of that as being a kind of true form as well. It's, I guess, difficult. It seems like there are kind of nested form takings within like visual processing, but even like a simple percept like is itself a kind of action on the world, in the sense that it organizes it into a new stabilization that could be further acted on.
Yeah, so I think a good example of this is, I think maybe it was like last week or maybe the week before, we were talking about how you can sort of map the sort of Husserlian analysis of what it is to perceive a physical object, you know, onto the concepts that Ruyer is talking about here. So, of course, to see something as a table and not just as like a sort of color patch on that you're seeing in your visual field, part of what it is that you're sort of doing when you grasp it as a table is that you are anticipating that if you were to walk around the table, you would, you know, continue to see like the sort of expected table shape on the other side as well. And, you know, of course, if you know, our sort of capacity to recognize tables is not infallible. It's possible that what looks like a table is actually just an elaborate, cardboard cutout with a super realistic picture of a table on it. And then if you walk around, you'll see that it's, you know, just a cardboard cutout. That'd be very surprising, of course, that, you know, when you walk into an apartment and see what looks like a table, you don't, usually think, oh, maybe this is actually just a cardboard cutout. But, you know, of course, there are weird circumstances. Maybe you happen to walk into a movie set or whatever. Part of our, you know, grasp of something as a table, it seems like so sort of immediate that you just sort of step into a room and you just see the table. Part of what we're doing is precisely that anticipation of, you know, what I would see if I were to, you know, walk around the table, or, you know, what I would feel if I were to reach out and touch the table, et cetera, all the other sense modalities. And then also the other sort of direction, of course, is that you can only, like, after you do walk around the table, you have to sort of connect what you're seeing now to what you saw, you know, a second ago from the other side of the table. You have to sort of reach backwards and, identify what it is you're seeing now with what you were seeing before as, like, you know, the same object seen from a different perspective. What seems to be this sort of very immediate relationship to this table that you're seeing in front of you is actually this pretty elaborate grasping of a temporal arrangement of experiences that, you know, it's only because you are capable of making these kinds of connections that you are capable of seeing something as a table in the first place. There's this kind of, and this sort of temporal structure, I think, has that same sort of pattern that we've been coming across in many of these works, this sort of melodic structure, in the sense that it's not that you have, like, a table snapshot at time one, and then a different table snapshot at time two, and then you sort of, like, secondarily compare them with each other and go, yeah, these are sort of consistent with the hypothesis that there's a table in front of me. It's rather that, the sort of temporal connection is, like, intrinsic to the experience of something as a table. And, you know, learning to, like, it takes a sort of learning and practice and effort to sort of force yourself to see the table snapshot, you know, the perspectival projection of the table onto your retina or onto the sort of visual plane in front of you, like when you're learning how to draw. What comes first is the melodic structure, the sort of grasp of the temporal flow of experience that is characteristic of seeing a table as you walk around it. And then it's only secondarily that you can sort of force yourself or train yourself to see the table snapshot as opposed to the table object.
Yeah, I think this is a good example where you can sort of see the two different temporal domains here, the sort of past, present, future domain of time versus this sort of unidimensional time of the absolute domain. Because, I mean, so I'm not quite sure what you mean by a true form at the percept, but to me, there's kind of two different things happening here. You perceive the table, but then there's a second thing that happens sort of now it's in the past of that initial perception, which is the conception of this as a table. He had said on the previous page, consciousness is not distinct from the intuitive or symbolic domain on which it is exerted. So now you have sort of this this conception, which is now happening in the past of the perception. So this absolute domain is necessarily functioning outside of a strict temporal sequence, or else it wouldn't be able to act on this, right? I mean, that's how I'm understanding.
I think that would be sort of pushing into a separate, I kind of want to say faculty as a, you know, sort of Kantian term, but maybe that's a little too sort of dry here, but a sort of separate ability that humans have. So, you know, a person who grows up in, you know, say an English-speaking, you know, Western country is going to be familiar with the word table and, you know, sort of the general concept of what kinds of things are tables or are, you know, designated as tables. So you have this concept that you have learned how to apply, and you know, most adults with normal sort of development and visual perception, etc., can very reliably pick out which objects are tables. And you know, this is how, of course, our CAPTCHAs work, and click on the traffic lights or whatever. So you've learned this concept, and you can reliably apply it to things that you experience. But sort of prior to that, there has to be, like, in order for you to be able to, reliably apply this word or this concept to, the right objects, or the objects that everyone else applies it to, you have to be able to grasp the object in the first place. So, I mean, the table is something that you're familiar with in this conceptual sense. You have this word that you can apply to the table, but you can, you can walk into an art gallery and there's some object of some kind. You have no sort of concept of what this is, other than maybe, thing that you find in an art gallery, or, probably an artwork, I guess. But you can't really classify what it is. You know, it's not a painting. It's not maybe it's a sculpture. It's hard to tell. But it's still this object, whatever it is, you still, by virtue of the fact that you are perceiving it as a physical object, you have to be able to grasp that it is the same object as you walk around it, or as your eye moves from top to bottom or whatever. Like, over time, you're grasping it as the same object. You're not just sort of experiencing a flow of color patches in your visual field. You're grasping this object as, located at this position in space relative to me, as, the same object as I walk around it. You sort of expect that if you were to touch it, you would, feel some surface, whether it's hard or, furry or whatever it is. So this whole sort of grasp of the temporal structure of, So you're sort of, even this, like, sort of limit case of, like, you have no idea what this thing is, you're still grasping it as an object of some kind, a physical object that will sort of behave in these sort of more or less predictable ways as you, observe it in different ways, as you potentially interact with it. I mean, art galleries usually don't let you, pick things up and move them around, but you can sort of suppose that if you were to pick up this object, you would feel a certain weight in your hand, etc. It's this sort of first initial grasp of the object as something that would behave in these sort of predictable ways if you were to interact with it or to walk around it or whatever. That's sort of like the first step. And then maybe you sort of read the panel at the art gallery and it says, this is actually, this object is an X. It does this, comes from this country, etc. So you have a conceptual grasp of what this object is, and you maybe learn how to apply this concept to new X's that you encounter. And that's the sort of second step. It's not the same thing as just sort of grasping it as an object in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's what I was saying is this, these, the perception of this object is prior to the conception of the object. So it's sort of these are separate events.
So I think the key point here is that already at the level of perception, you're already sort of engaged in this, or you're already grasping the object as having, or sorry, you're grasping your, by grasping this as a physical object, you are engaged in this sort of melodic structure, this sort of absolute domain, sort of unification, sort of enterprise. It's only because you are a true form that is capable of, this kind of absolute survey, that you are capable of grasping something as an object in the first place. And then, secondarily, you can also learn concepts. You can, apply the name of this, type of entity that you have just learned. That's a secondary skill that you can, acquire. But already, even just perceiving something as a physical object requires that absolute survey that is only possible because you are a true form.
Okay. Yeah. I think that. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, to understand this, melody as a melody as a whole. If it just occurs in a strict temporal sequence, that could never occur, I guess, is what he's getting at here. That it that it requires this ability to have this entire experience that can move kind of across this temporal space all at once in either direction.
Yeah, and so again, this is just sort of building on the sort of classic Gestalt theory argument that, you know, hearing note one, the sort of experience of hearing note one and then the experience of hearing note two is not the same thing as the experience of hearing the sequence note one and note two. So, you know, these two sort of experiences, if they were sort of like self-contained, you know, fully sort of enclosed sort of atomic experiences, there's no way to get from those sort of atomic experiences of hearing a note to the experience of hearing this, you know, simple melody, this sequence of two notes. This is sort of what is sort of, you know, expanded out into this idea of this melodic structure is this sort of intrinsic unity through time that is not sort of not reducible to just a sequence of atoms that are sort of external to each other. The melody is not simply the experienced melody is not simply a sequence of experiences of notes.
Yeah, it's something that it seems obvious, but I think it's a pretty elegant argument here, the way he's laying it out, because he really shows how all of these other approaches to this kind of break down at a certain level, you know, and so he's inserting this absolute domain as a necessary, I don't know if you would call it an agent, but means to this activity.
Yeah, I was thinking about the temporal extension point. I think it maybe in the last reading group session, I mentioned Churchland's book, where he kind of explains basically transtemporal universals in terms of recurrent activation patterns in these like Hebbian neural networks in the brain. Something that I was just thinking about is the difference between so the neural activation could, in principle, you know, be explained step by step entirely, so that, you know, each kind of step is sufficient to itself and causes the next one. But it's sort of actualist. There's no kind of reaching across either side of the present into the past or into the future. But the subjective correlate of that does have this quality of anticipation and retention. So there is a kind of there seems to be a disjunction, which is probably the kind of thing Rie is talking about with the two directions of time in the Wiener example. So the neural activation pattern can be explained step by step, but experientially there has to be this, you know, protension and retention structure, which is I guess ecstatic in Heidegger's sense. It's sort of beyond the present in both directions.
Yeah, I think throughout this book he's talked you know, sort of mostly in fairly general terms about you know, brain function, and he's sort of used this embryo brain analogy throughout the book, but I think, yeah, as we've, you know, talked about earlier today, that he's not sort of saying, oh, we can explain this sort of, you know, cognitive performance by supposing that there's like a little ghost inside your head that you know, looks at your retina or looks at your brain patterns or whatever. So he's not sort of trying to give an explanation that you know, is sort of like adding something on to the brain in that sense. So the operation of this true form that is, you know, you as a person, this operation is not something, you know, separate from the brain. It's something that is a a sort of pattern of the acting of the brain. And I think this is something that even comes up in, like, there's lots of sort of areas where this kind of potentiality, I guess, as a sort of essential element of understanding a subject matter comes in. So, like, even, like, so this is something that, like, in analytic philosophy, when they talk about, like, dispositions, there's a whole sort of, you know, subfield related, you know, dedicated to the concept of disposition. So when you describe, when you say that sugar is soluble in water, you're not just saying that, like, this specific, you know, chunk of sugar has dissolved. You're saying that, you know, this other chunk of sugar that I didn't put in water would have dissolved if I had put it in water. So there's a kind of subjunctive sort of element to what you're saying when you describe something as soluble. And that, you know, that chunk of sugar might never, you know, ever, like, in all of its existence, might be, you know, hundreds of kilometers away from any water that it could dissolve into. And, you know, until the end of the universe, that piece of sugar is never dissolved, but you can still say that sugar was soluble, because if it had been, you know, immersed in water, it would have dissolved. And so likewise, in the case of, you know, understanding the way that the brain works, you can sort of focus on the actual events that happen. Say, you know, you can use an fMRI and, you know, watch where there's more brain activity while the subject is doing a certain task, etc. But I think the sort of level of understanding that Rie is operating on is at this level of sort of potential, or brings in the potential in this intrinsic way that is not reducible to what actually happens. And so, so like if you use like this sort of Hebbian learning or any of these sort of simple learning algorithms, you can sort of show how the model, this like neural net model, or even a more realistic model of a brain, how it did learn X, how it, you know, it learned how to you know, identify triangles or distinguish triangles from squares or whatever. So it did learn X, and then, you know, as a result of that, it has a certain set of weights that allow it to, you know, perform this task of distinguishing triangles from squares. But then there's also this sort of potential side of things, in that if the you know, chicken or whatever it is that you're experimenting on had been exposed to a different set of stimuli, you know, in its learning history, in its life history, then it would have learned something different. And so it's this kind of subjunctive aspect, I think, is part of what is not grasped when you're just sort of explaining things in terms of the causal interaction of these simple neural net nodes in like, yeah, this sort of simple learning models, like, yeah, Hebbian learning. Okay, so I think we can go on to the next bit. So we'll start the next chapter. Just give me a second. Okay. Yeah, so I'll read the first bit. Chapter 12, the region of the transspatial and the transindividual. It is impossible to understand the world of space, time, and individuals unless we consider it a kind of limit to a natural world or region, but of an entirely different nature than our visible world, a region in which the spatial or temporal, quote-unquote, step-by-step, does not reign, and in which the analogical, quote-unquote, same, and the numerical, quote-unquote, same, blend together. This is a region of essences, ideas, forms, and mnemic themes. The main trait of the domains of absolute survey is to make these ideas, forms, these transspatial essences, visible in the observable geometric structure of the spatial-temporal world. A sensory cerebral area, or rather its real and auto-subjective counterpart, can be compared to a one-way mirror which, on one hand, receives the physical images of the observed objects, and on the other, reflects the essences of the transspatial world that correspond to these objects. The region of essences and themes should not be situated in some mythical geography like the one that amused Plato. It can be reached through positive descriptions of a certain number of psychological facts, all of which reveal the same structure. A. Mnemic evocation and invention. Bats had been using ultrasound to explore obstacles for millions of years when P. Langevin designed his receptor and emitter device to explore marine obstacles. To produce ultrasound, the bat does not use piezoelectricity like the industrial device, but it has to resolve the same technical difficulties, e.g. emitting wave trains short enough that they would not scramble the echo. We do not generally observe the same degree of resemblance between two independent inventions as between two evocations of the same memory. If I have for a second time a complex idea that I'd already had, it will likely resemble its first image in my mind more than its image in the mind of another man. Once discovered, invented, and become a memory for me, an idea will be more easily at my disposal and will also have a better defined nature than a universal essence. Ordinary reminiscence is easier than big R reminiscence in the Platonic sense. But even this is not always true, as experimental psychology has demonstrated, and in every case, there must logically be a reason for the resemblance. The resemblance of two geographically independent inventions, like the resemblance of two evocations of a same memory, has to find its reason in a transspatial, quote-unquote, nature. I'm going to read to the end of A here. It is very typical that the, quote-unquote, actualist and, quote-unquote, existentialist conceptions deny at once, one, constituted and unconscious individual memory, two, specific memory, the reason for the resemblance of one human to another, or one animal to another of the same species, and three, the world of essences and values independent of our whims. In their own way, these conceptions acknowledge the solidarity of the three orders of reality. That this negation is insupportable is, in any case, clear for individual memory and specific memory. We have to account for the fact that two swallows or two humans resemble each other. The reason does not reside in a kind of material, quote-unquote, negative from which they are drawn, like two mass-produced objects. But this does not exempt us from searching for and finding the reason elsewhere. The same logical obligation equally holds for the resemblance of two inventions in all domains, and more clearly in domains in which the discoveries obey such rigorous norms that they can be rigorously identical, for example, mathematics or technology. We should not succumb to the illusion of believing that the resemblance of two inventions can be explained in the same way as the resemblance of two phenomena of macroscopic physics. There is also something typical about the form and evolution of a delta, the form and evolution of the meanders of a stream, of a cumulus, of a volcanic eruption, because common nouns are used to designate them. Yet this, quote-unquote, typicality is secondary and derived. It is sufficiently explained by the play of causes at work in these phenomena, which always operate in the same way. Strictly speaking, an invention has no cause. It differs by definition from a functioning. The resemblance of two inventions cannot be placed without contradiction on the same plane as the resemblance of two erosions. Even in the domain of classical physics, by ascending from cause to cause, we arrive at the quote-unquote nature of the primary physical beings at issue, which, strictly speaking, do not have a cause and respond to a quote-unquote type. The resemblance of two iron molecules cannot be explained in the same way as the resemblance of two cumuli. A molecule conforms to a norm that can be analyzed mathematically, but not, strictly speaking, causally. The application of mathematics differs profoundly depending on whether micro or macroscopic physics is at issue. In macroscopic physics, mathematics allows us to follow the deduction of causality from primary types to derived quote-unquote types. For instance, the geographer mathematician will calculate the formation time of a particular type of delta from the flow of sediments, the nature of the shoreline, and the adverse action of the waves. In microscopic physics, by contrast, the mathematician does not have to deduce the effect phenomena from the cause phenomena. An iron molecule is obviously not formed in the manner of a delta. So long as the choice was only between the irrational negation of the absolute empiricists or existentialists and the mythical substantialization of essences or types in a transcendent sight, it was possible to hesitate, although in any case, a mythical image of reality is always worth more than a logical absurdity. No doubt the quote-unquote swallow type or the quote-unquote human type, the essences or values in their atemporal status, cannot be imagined as an idea enthroned in the heavens and contemplated admiringly by beings that strive to imitate it. But the attentive observation of the facts of memory and of the true modes of reminiscence can give a positive meaning and value to the old Platonic reconciliation of invention and memory. So here I think maybe a good analogy to bring up is these cases of like independent invention or independent discovery, where you have two or more people working independently of each other that arrive at, you know, the same or basically the same invention without, either one knowing of the other. And, you know, there have been cases of this happening. And then also, you know, in sort of scientific discovery, there are also cases of this. So, of course, you have like Newton and Leibniz independently developing calculus. It seems like Newton was first to come up with it, but then he never published it for many years, and then Leibniz published it first, and then there was this, you know, long priority dispute that got, you know, tied up with nationalism, etc. But in any case, there's something like even just to be able to say that, you know, two people made the same discovery or the same invention independently, there has to be something common to the whatever it is that these two people have produced. And so one sort of way of explaining this would be to say that this is just sort of like the result of the same kind of process. So in the same way that, like, you know, rivers, tend to produce the same types of riverbeds in different, you know, places. And of course, it depends on, you know, what exactly the river is flowing over, you know, what is the slope, et cetera. But if you have like, you know, similar circumstances, a river flowing over similar types of rock with a similar slope and so on, you would expect to have a similar, you know, form of riverbed, river delta, et cetera. Everything would just sort of, you would expect to find the same product as a result of the geological evolution of this river region, if the sort of circumstances are similar in both cases. So you could say that, parallel invention or, you know, simultaneous independent invention of the same thing would be sort of like the same kind of process as, you know, two rivers resulting in similar shapes as a result of, you know, similar processes. The whole book essentially is an argument against this position, showing that we can't understand invention, in the true sense, as just being a product of a certain sort of arrangement of physical forces, or this sort of interaction of an aggregate of entities. But I think an interesting point here to mention that he doesn't really bring up is that when there are these sort of like, you know, priority disputes and so on, often what is sort of like the, or what is often treated as sort of like a key piece of evidence that, say, one person didn't actually independently invent this this device, but secretly copied the first person, is if there are sort of elements that are not essential to the, you know, functioning of this device that are repeated, that are found in one and in the other. So if you just have two inventions and, you know, the sort of intrinsic or like essential elements of the two inventions are the same, you could say, okay, the two people, you know, independently figured out that, you know, to make this device work, you have to, you know, arrange things in this way. But then if there's some sort of like, you know, arbitrary or, you know, inessential element of this device, that you could do it in any of five different ways. And then, you know, someone, you know, just happens to, you know, have picked the exact same way as the other person, then you can, you know, be a little bit suspicious that maybe it wasn't actually an independent invention and it was actually, you know, copied from the first one. And then, of course, if there are, you know, multiple like independent choices, you know, in the design of this device, you know, where you could select from, you know, say one of five or one of 10 different, you know, ways of arranging this component. And, you know, in, you know, six or seven of these, you know, sort of degrees of freedom, the second device, you know, follows the pattern of the first one, then you start being, you know, pretty confident that it is not actually a sort of independent invention and that it was copied from the first one. And so this sort of, this, you know, distinction between, say, like the essential structure of the invention on the one hand, that you know, potentially could have been reached by multiple people independently, and then the sort of arbitrary choices that you know, you have to pick one of these options, but which one you pick is sort of arbitrary, or at least, you know, open to multiple decisions. This is already sort of like pointing to the fact that an invention is not sort of reducible to just a sort of causal product of you know, interacting forces, in the sense that, you know, yeah, you're sort of recognizing that there is an essential structure of the invention, just because you are also, like, just by distinguishing what is essential and not essential in the invention when you're sort of you know, doing detective work to see if you know, these two alleged inventors really are independent or not. So just by doing that, you're sort of grasping the invention as such, as a kind of essential, as a kind of essence, as something that is not itself a physical product, even though, of course, you know, the invention is only really an invention if it is realized physically. So I think that's maybe, it's not sort of directly in the text here, but I think this is sort of like a way of getting at what he's talking about here, is the fact that, you know, even by sort of recognizing two products as, you know, potentially independently invented, or sort of independent versions of the same invention, just by sort of grasping them in that sense, you are sort of treating an invention as something that is not sort of analogous to, you know, a river delta.
Yeah, I was thinking about the difference between the erosion example and invention when I was reading this earlier. And I wonder if Rouillet would say that, you know, any creation of form is somehow, you know, accesses this this transpatial realm or a mnemic theme. You know, something like erosion, I guess, is a good example of a process that doesn't create formlessly, because it just sort of just kind of an aggregate falling apart. Whereas an invention is highly complex and informative, and yeah, as you mentioned, there are sort of essential and inessential aspects to it that can be distinguished. But yeah, I don't know if any form taking would be a true form for Rouillet, or if that would that position would run into, you know, some of the difficult limit cases that we've discussed previously.
My sense is that I think he would identify, you know, form taking and you know, true form as a sort of like coordinate concepts, but the sort of caveat is that not every phenomenon that produces, you know, some sort of characteristic shape or characteristic, you know, form in the sort of broader sense is a form taking in the sort of specific sense. And so some of the examples that he gives here, like like a river delta, you know, there is a sort of like characteristic shape, like just the term delta, of course, it comes from the, you know, the characteristic shape of, you know, what the, you know, deposition of sediment in a river, in the mouth of a river, you know, tends to look like. And so there is this sort of, you know, characteristic shape that is produced, but it is that is not a form taking in the proper sense of the term. It's not sort of analogous to the way that an embryo, you know, takes on form. It's it's a very simple sort of aggregation of, you know, sediment at the mouth of a river. So I think it, as long as we sort of use the term form taking only to refer to this sort of invention side of things, or this, you know, the types of processes that have this invention quality to them, and that includes, you know, inventions that have already been produced, and you know, embryology or the development of an embryo is an invention, but it is an invention that is sort of reproducing a pattern that already existed, as he points out here. So the individual embryo doesn't have to sort of figure out for itself, you know, what kind of adult it's going to turn into, but it still has to, I guess, figure out how to turn itself into that adult that it is directed towards. So it's not that, you know, any embryo could become, you know, an oak tree or a fish or a bird. You know, this embryo can only become, you know, the type of adult that it's the embryo of. But it still has to sort of invent its own form, its own adult form, and, you know, it has to make its own organs and so on. So yeah, this kind of, you know, I guess bounded invention, you could say, or like constrained invention, is sort of characteristic of form taking. And I think if we limit the term form taking to this kind of process, then he would say that only true forms are sort of engage in that form taking. And then things like, you know, the river delta, that, you know, is sort of regularly has the same shape, would not be a form taking in his sense.
Yeah, I feel the way I'm getting this, I'm this is almost leaving it, almost oversimplifying or leaving it too open to kind of a subjectivity. But I feel like I went back through the book. There would be many examples that he points out here, but it can be as simple as the difference between a true form and just, you know, otherwise is, you know, true form is something that at some point almost necessarily disobeys the law of entropy, the law of thermodynamics, and like in an embryonic formation, almost like, so the end goal is there, but it's not just a simple step by step by step. And we may call it that, but as he pointed out, probably in that chapter, I could find some examples. It might encounter certain scenarios where it's almost necessarily not just to kind of go around this barrier, but to reverse and try a new tact, a new approach. And that this is evidence of true form. And I can think of how, just broadly speaking, we tend to just say, like, now our hand-waving explanation about this is just sheer probability of numbers, you know, and, you know, in an infinite number of universes, there's just a probability that this occurrence would happen. And I think where we're forced to apply that, you could almost say that that this is where an absolute domain or a true form is acting.
Yeah, so at one level, there's a sort of epistemological I guess arguments to be made here that, like, we only attribute or we only have sort of evidence of a true form being present when there is this kind of apparent violation of of the arrow of time, the thermodynamic arrow of time. So that, like, in the case of the river, if we think of, like, sort of detour behavior in animals and you compare it to, say, a river, so the river flowing downhill, if you, you know, block the flow of the river, the water just keeps flowing and it will, produce, say, a lake, or a reservoir. If you dam the river, for example, the water just keeps flowing and just fills up until, you know, the water in the reservoir or, you know, the new lake that's being formed is level with wherever the water is flowing from, and then, you know, of course, just through sort of like gravitational equilibrium, once the water level is stable, it, you know, the water will not flow anymore just because there's nowhere for it to flow to. And so, like, you can sort of look at this, you know, the river is dammed. You sort of look at the water, you know, as if it were sort of trying to continue flowing downhill. But the water will never, stop flowing downhill in this direction and try a different direction, if that makes sense. Whereas, of course, if you have an animal, you could even set up, like, you know, the maze to be like to have the exact, you know, shape of the hillside that the river is flowing down, and, you know, have the reward be, you know, at the bottom, and, you know, do the exact same sort of arrangement where you set up a dam or a blockage of, you know, the path that the animal has learned down the hill. The animal will not just sort of like keep running into the wall until it, like, sort of backs up and flows around the wall in the way that the water would. The animal that encounters a wall will explore until it finds a way, of going around or over or under or whatever. It will, explore its surroundings to find a way of achieving its goal of reaching that reward. This is sort of like it's a very, you know, simple example, but it just shows a difference between goal directedness in the case of the animal and a very simple, you know, physical process of water flowing downhill on the other hand. This is a sort of external goal. The animal has a place it's trying to reach that is, you know, outside of itself. It has this, you know, there's food at the end of this maze or whatever. But there's also this sort of intrinsic finality in the way that the embryo develops into the adult mouse or whatever it is. And this same intrinsic, this intrinsic finality also has a similar sort of capacity to adapt to, you know, to take detours in a sort of metaphorical sense, because, you know, all these examples that he's discussed earlier in this book, where, you know, you take the early embryo and you slice it in half, you don't get like, you know, two half mice that, like, you know, a front half and a back half, which of course would not be viable. Instead, you would get like two smaller adult mice. So the embryo is sort of responding to this, you know, obstacle in its trajectory towards an adult mouse. It does that by sort of adapting the way that it develops, and so something that maybe would have been would have developed into like a torso segment of the mouse in a sort of normal developmental process now ends up becoming a hind leg or whatever. So the embryo sort of trajectory towards an adult mouse is capable of taking a detour in the same way that, you know, the mouse as an organism, you know, trying to reach a goal is capable of taking a detour, whereas, you know, the river is not capable of taking a detour. It just, you know, flows wherever the gravity gradient sort of takes it.
Yeah, I feel like I've sort of alluded to this previously, but you know, here is where the current paradigms, you know, the just strict genetic determinism, they're going to say, well, it's just the genes, and this is the way it's playing out, and over time, you know, evolution, natural selection allows for different routes, the stream to flow in different ways as necessitated by the environment. But this is, to me, just an incredibly inadequate way for this to happen. And when, if you really dig into it, you can see where this just is not possible. You know, so an embryo in development, if it encounters one of these barriers that is standing in the way of the strict genetic determinism, then the embryo has no choice but to either be stunted in some way or just stop development and die. And instead, you know, I think what there's plenty of evidence actually, I think in the data that we do have that the cell is more of an openly creative and playful environment where it's constantly like at any one time there are multiple possible routes. It's constantly playing, and mutations aren't just random and sometimes fortuitous, but they're actually intentional so that the environment or development does remain open, so that when a barrier is encountered, there's a different possible route to take. You know, I mean, and it's not, I'm not saying that there's infinite possibility there, but you know, there's possibility within a certain range. You know, and here the genetic basis of the cell does somewhat define that available range, but that is how the cell is developing, not just following a strict step-by-step-by-step playing out of what the gene tells it to, but that it is this kind of active, creative space. So I don't know. To me, what he's saying here is laying out how this, you know, it's sort of a similar argument or the same argument. So, but there is some mechanistic basis for what he's saying here.
Yeah. So he mentions an existentialist conception. I think he's actually using this term in a slightly different way than sort of the typical one, but I think he does mention Sartre at one point here, and this sort of absolute freedom conception. Of course, existentialism generally was not that, you know, interested in you know, biology or anything like that, but you could sort of, you know, suppose like an existentialist biology that would just sort of take the embryo to have this sort of absolute freedom. And of course, this is kind of an absurd position, because we know that, yeah, the acorn is not going to turn into a chicken. You know, the chicken's egg is not going to grow into an oak tree, etc. You know, no matter what sort of interventions you do on this chicken embryo, it's not going to turn into an oak tree. And also, you know, even, you know, in the case of these, like the sea urchin embryo that is, you know, capable of adapting to, you know, some pretty extreme interventions, you know, being sliced in half and so on. Of course, there are other interventions that it is not capable of adapting to. You know, if you like douse it in cyanide or something, it's probably not going to survive. yeah, so there are, you know, limits to this adaptability and, you know, creativity, I guess, of the embryo. You know, the embryo is, so this is sort of the term I was using earlier, this sort of like bounded invention. You know, the sea urchin embryo is sort of inventing an adult sea urchin form within itself. But it's not just sort of, you know, left with a blank canvas and, you know, sort of free to invent whatever it, you know, comes into its sea urchin embryo head. It will form an adult sea urchin, you know, as well as it can, you know, under the circumstances. If some, you know, experimenter slices it in half, it will, you know, adapt to that circumstance and form two sea urchins and so on. But yeah, if it's doused in cyanide, then it just doesn't have the capacity to, you know, overcome that particular obstacle, as far as I know. I'm not an expert in sea urchin, you know, biochemistry by any means. but yeah, so this, it's a kind of inventiveness or creativity, without being a sort of like absolute freedom with no sort of bounds or, you know, guidelines or anything like that. So, and this is also the case in, you know, most human behavior as well, is that, you know, whatever, you know, leaving aside the sort of like determinism versus free will kind of debate, you know, whenever you're making a decision, you're usually doing so under certain constraints, that you have to, you know, achieve certain, like you're trying to achieve a certain goal. You have things that you either physically can't do or you're sort of, not willing to do. And so you're left with a certain number of options, you know, under these constraints. And then you sort of like, you know, select one of these options, you know, based on whatever criteria. So yeah, like even just sort of banal examples, like, you know, picking what you're going to order at a restaurant, you know, you're sort of, maybe you have, you know, food preferences or, you know, religious, restrictions on what you're allowed to eat and so on. You sort of operate within constraints. And then of course you can only order what's on the menu. Usually, you know, some restaurants you can, you know, ask for some, you know, special order. Anyway, there are constraints on what you can order at the restaurant. And even, you know, you have the constraint of like being in a restaurant situation where you are expected to order some kind of food, is already a constraint on your behavior in this scenario. So yeah, in general, we're not sort of making decisions in this like completely open and featureless realm of absolute freedom. We're, you know, making decisions under certain constraints and trying to, you know, satisfy different criteria, in sort of like a best compromise way. And so this is probably a sort of model for what the embryo is doing, obviously not in the same sort of reflective way that a person might when they're making a decision. But, you know, the embryo has like different sort of constraints on what it can do, and sort of works to, you know, pursue the sort of trajectory towards an adult organism under the constraints that it's operating within.
I know we're running out of time, but I was thinking about the river detour example. you know, Rouye, as we know, also holds that atoms and molecules are true forms. And I think he would argue that they sort of similarly, I mean, I think he has argued that they sort of persist in that form. But I mean, I guess that works. I don't know. I was thinking like there isn't like an equivalent to like complex detour behavior at the level of the molecule, but or the atom. But obviously the persistence in its true form of the atom is a very powerful tendency. So I think that even those inorganic phenomena are distinct from inorganic aggregates.
Yeah, so I think we could take the, you know, the fact that it requires this very high energy, you know, operation to, you know, split an atom. We can take that as a kind of indication that there is this sort of very like the glue that holds the atom together is very strong, very sticky. obviously, glue here in a very abstract sense. I think maybe one sort of disanalogy here is that, of course, the embryo as a true form, or, you know, the mouse or the oak tree or whatever it is as a true form, is made up of many you know, aggregates. You know, the mouse you know, has all kinds of like tissues within its body that are not themselves sort of true forms. They're just, you know, there's like bone that is just a sort of mass of you know, materials in this, like, bone is a similar sort of entity as you know, a wooden spoon or whatever, like just something that is an aggregate, even though it is formed by this living being, you know, within itself. The bone is not sort of itself a true form. And so, you know, the embryo that can sort of respond to these sort of interventions and still, you know, result in a more or less normal adult organism, it is sort of like the embryo or like the living being's sort of true form is a kind of pattern that's in a sense superimposed on something, on an aggregate, or that, you know, contains aggregates within it. Whereas an atom doesn't exactly contain an aggregate, I guess. Like, you can sort of, I guess, like intellectually sort of decompose an atom into the, you know, particles that make it up, and then, you know, take the atom pattern to be sort of like superimposed on those particles. But then, of course, yeah, like, you eventually sort of bottom out with entities that are not themselves, or that, as far as we know, are not composed of anything else. Quarks, or, you know, electrons, I believe, are also at that level. you have these entities that have a true form, but are not sort of, that form is not sort of a form of something else. It's not a form of some kind of matter underlying it. And so I think that's, yeah, sort of different in some respects than the case of the sea urchin embryo, which is form of some matter, which, you know, over the lifespan of that embryo, you'll have, you know, atoms flowing in and out of that embryo, you know, over time, even though the embryo itself is sort of persisting as a form. The matter that makes up that embryo is changing over time. As far as we know, you know, electrons are not sort of taking in nutrition from their environment, and sort of like having a you know, a flow of some sub electron entity in and out. It's a sort of an aside, but there's a sort of anecdote about I think it's like not super well confirmed, but about Einstein. Of course, there's many like sort of fake Einstein quotes floating around the internet, so yeah, take with a grain of salt. But so in like the 1950s. They were doing, you know, this is when sort of particle accelerator experiments were taking off, and the whole sort of standard model of particle physics and this sort of like zoo of different particles were being identified. And, you know, some of them later turned out to be like the same particle, just like from different sort of perspectives. But anyway, someone asked Einstein, what do you think about like quarks and all these weird things that we're finding? And he says, I would just like to know what an electron is. So I guess, yeah, if he had just read Ruyer, he would just, yeah, he would have an answer to his question. An electron is a tiny embryo.
Yeah, I feel like I need to reread the book up to this point, because I feel like he's given this exact answer, but it's sort of like the difference between the true form, like an embryo, versus like the river, is these true forms are active, like. A constant activity, whereas the other non-true forms, they form and they're sort of static at that point and less acted upon, whereas these true forms are constantly acting in their own space. I don't know.
I think that's right. The one sort of complication here is that static doesn't necessarily mean non-changing. So of course, if you take, you know, vinegar and baking soda and mix them together, you'll get, you know, the every you know, 6 year old's favorite science experiment. That, you know, it does produce, you know, action in a sense. But, you know, this is just, you know, once that chemical reaction happens, that's it. You know, there's just this, you know, one sort of exciting burst of, you know, foam, and then it's done. Whereas a living being is not just sort of one sort of burst of action. It's this sort of constant self-reinforcing action. So the living being is not just bringing about this chemical reaction or you know, descending the gradient of entropy or whatever. Ascending the gradient of entropy. It is taking in nutrients and engaging in behaviors that sort of enhance its capacity to continue to exist and continue to act through time. A living being will, try to escape threats or, try to counter the threats and it will try to find the nutrients it needs, et cetera. So yeah, a living being, doesn't just sort of respond in this immediate way to whatever it encounters in the way that the vinegar and baking soda responds to encountering each other. It's as if like the vinegar, sought out the baking soda and, once it started, exhausting its supply of baking soda, it would like order more from Amazon or something. That's sort of like what the living being is doing.
Yeah. Like a living being, a true form is always attaining its form. It's in constant formation or whatever, active formation.
Yeah.
So it's toward a goal, like this, but never necessarily reaching that goal.
Yeah.
So reach that goal to be done.
As if the baking soda vinegar reaction was constantly sort of bringing in more baking soda and vinegar to keep the reaction going. Which obviously is not fortunately for anyone who is a parent of a child doing a science fair demo. That is not the case. Okay, so I think, so we're at about our 2-hour mark, so we can stop here. Okay, cool. So, stay tuned for schedule updates. So probably in 2 weeks. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Sounds good. Thank you.